Hey, it's Shimon, and this is the Faith Through Music podcast. Here, we speak with artists, creators, and musicians about how faith influences their music and how music influences their faith. Today, I have the pleasure to speak with Dov Rosenblatt. Dov is one of the founding members of the Jewish rock band Blue Fringe and the folk pop trio Distant Cousins. His music has both advanced Jewish rock and been featured in movies, TV shows, and commercials around the world. Today we discuss the start of Blue Fringe and the song Flippin' Out going viral before viral was a thing. The joy of hearing his music in movies and TV, performing in Carnegie Hall, the intersection of songwriting and prayer, and so much more. Dov, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's jump right into it. Where did your passion for music start? Did you come from a family that of musicians, or how did that start for you?
Yeah, so it started at a young age. I did not come from a family of musicians, a musical family, but not musicians. There's a difference, I guess. I always felt like if my dad grew up with a bass instrument, he'd probably be a great bassist, but he just didn't. But always growing up listening to music, he would like point out the bass lines and stuff. So I grew up with like a real appreciation for it. And I'm actually named for my grandmother, who I never met, my mom's mom, who was a piano teacher. Apparently she was incredible, and I have her piano, which is like a 100-year-old piano here at my home in Los Angeles. So there was always music around, I'm sure, with many families. And then I guess when I was about 7 or 8, my parents got me a little keyboard for like a long road trip, and they said, I don't really remember it obviously, but my parents have told me the story a lot, that I was like in the back seat kind of playing by ear, like figuring out songs. And they were like, oh, okay, I guess
he does the music thing.
Yeah. So it really kind of started from there. And then ever since like second grade, I've been writing songs, and I had a band in second grade, and like we went to a music studio, and I really remember vividly, because it just blew my mind, like walking into a professional music studio as a kid and you see all the knobs and the console and the microphones. I was like, I want to do that. So it started like really young.
Pretty crazy starting that early. I feel like very few people definitely have that experience, and even like stepping into a studio. It's actually funny because I remember the only time I've ever really been in a real music studio is when I was in high school. Our science teacher decided to take us to the studio where like the B-52s recorded and stuff like that. And it was like we did a couple like Jewish songs. I don't even know what we did, but it was just like a really cool experience of like being in that like studio. And like, I think it was an old like theater. Like I think Elvis had played on that stage, and it was just like a really interesting like vibe.
That's so cool. Yeah. I think what you picked up on and what I picked up on, and most people who step into a studio, is like, there's just this certain magic, you know, that you feel in the studio. And it's, I'm always still trying to grab onto that, you know, to tap into it.
Yeah. How'd you now get from second grade, you playing in a band, to then starting Blue Fringe? How did that trajectory happen?
Well, I'll give them much short. Nobody wants to hear that. It was definitely always just a hobby as a kid, and, you know, like school competitions and stuff, like singing a song in school bands, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I never really thought of it really realistically as a profession, honestly. It was just something fun and that I knew I loved. And then kind of fell into my lap when I was in Israel after high school. I studied at Yeshivat Har Etzion at Gush. Mm-hmm. And together with some friends for Purim spoof, we wrote Flippin' Out. It was with, I don't know if you know, Yitzi Spinner. He was in Miami Boys Choir. And there were a couple of us, and we worked on that. And, you know, that song just took off and took on a life of its own.
Life of its own, exactly.
Yeah, and so that, there was a yeshiva-wide Battle of the Bands that year, and we played that song, and it was just, I'm very much dating myself, but, you know, like, there wasn't even YouTube or anything back then. It was just, there was Napster. Mm-hmm. That's how old I am. Napster was around, and that recording of Flippin' Out started spreading. And so anyway, I got to YU and I asked some of my friends, one Chaim Danzig, who's the bassist who I went to school with at Gush, so I knew him. Uh-huh. And my longtime friend Avi Hoffman, who's the guitar player of Blue Fringe and songwriter. He's really, to this day, like one of my close friends, and just I'm in awe of his musicianship, and I always was as a kid. Like, we went to camp together, and he taught me guitar. So I said, let's put together this band for a concert. There was the university at Penn in Philly reached out, like, can you put together a concert? We love that Flippin' Out song. So we weren't even a band, really.
You're a one-hit wonder at that point.
Yeah, basically. And then Chaim knew his friend from Philly, Danny Zwillenberg. He's like, he's a great drummer. We actually had one other member, this guy, Matt Weinberg, at the time. He was the fifth. And then it was really like, it just all snowballed. It was immediate. Like, that first concert at Penn, we just put together a playlist. There were some other songs I had written that we quickly learned. And people, I remember, came over afterwards like, wow, that was great. What's your name? What's your band name? And we didn't have one at the time. Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, that's the next step. And then we just knew, you could sense that there was a chemistry and like something special was happening. And so that became like my entire college career for 4 years. Like, I'd say 3 out of 4 nights a week, the four of us went into an empty building at YU and practiced every night. It was incredible.
Were those writing sessions involved with that also? Like, were you guys writing and practicing and everything all together?
Yeah, good question. There were definitely times where we would jam and work, you know, and write something from scratch. The majority of the time, either I had an idea or Avi had an idea, actually. And then towards the third album, Danny started having cool lyric ideas. And so, yeah, there were different ways. Sometimes we would come in with the song. For sure, in the beginning, like the first album of Blue Fringe, I had most of the songs thought of and then presented it to the guys. And then they made them way better and like, well, try this. And so we all worked on it collaboratively.
Like, that's like the beauty of the songwriting process, especially when you're working with people. Like, it's always interesting these days. Like, people like say, oh, like, there's only one songwriting credit on a song or whatever. And it's like, it's each little element. I think it's funny. I heard an interview, some guy did with Lil Aaron. I don't know if you ever heard of him. Mm. He's like a punk rap kind of guy, but he's written like with Black Bear and different people in like the rap scene even. Like, he was talking about like the songwriting process and how like every, just the different little elements that come from each person's input into that process. Mm-hmm. And like, that's, it's like, oh, yeah, you want that group of people in a room because everyone knows that little thing that they could add that all together makes that song that much better.
Yeah, absolutely. And ideally, when it goes well, that is the best, when each person knows. And I feel really lucky because the band I'm in now, in particular Distant Cousins, like, all three of us, we're all writers and producers and everything, but we all really kind of find our place where we can contribute. And the important part, and I think also this comes with age, I guess, too, is like knowing when to step back and let the other person take the lead on what they're the best at. And I've been in lots of songwriting sessions over the years. And when I was in New York, there was a period of time, I don't know how many years, but like really trying to hustle the songwriting piece of my career. And like, I'd have like 2, sometimes 3 songwriting sessions booked in a day going from the East Side. And there were some times where you can tell someone is saying something just to be heard and just to try to get their stamp on it. And it's not necessarily all that productive or moving the song forward. So that's why I say, you know, in its ideal form, you have that kind of collaboration. But it's kind of a joke. Like, there are some producers who are like, well, what if instead of the, it's it, and then, oh, 20%, you know, it's like,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
What were those songwriting sessions like around the city? I feel like you probably ran into some interesting people around those times.
I loved that time. It was, well, for starters, I love the New York live music scene. I still feel like there's nothing better in the world. I mean, right now, again, like we said before, if it weren't COVID, ..
Yeah.
But I used to play a lot at this venue called Rockwood Music Hall, which now has turned into like a factory. But it was one little tiny room. And that's, I think, what the magic was, is like, you know, a window front storefront where people would walk by and just, you see someone on a stage singing and you walk in, and a lot of shows were free. And so it created this environment where a lot of songwriters were all showing up to each other's shows to support them and collaborate and get on stage and play a song. And so there was a real scene. I know it sounds a little cheesy, but there was some real camaraderie among the songwriters. And so you would say, oh, I loved your set. Like, we should write this week. And then you get together and then you meet someone, you write a cool song with them and they introduce you to someone. And there were producers I worked with. I definitely did, to be fair, I did a fair share of, you know, hustle on my own of like researching who produced this track, how can I get in touch with them, I want to work with them. And there's a lot of that, I think, if you want it, in New York. But one thing I would say in retrospect I didn't realize until I moved to Los Angeles was just the pace of it is so frenetic. I mean, that's New York City, mm-hmm. but the songwriting scene there too, it's just like I said, you're squeezing in like two or three a day. And sometimes, you know, by you get to that third session and you're just spent and it's hard to find that creative juice. But when I moved to LA, I felt that difference because here, first of all, everything was a lot more spread out. So just practically, it's like you have one session, that's your day. And, you know, it's someone has like a home studio where you go take a break with a coffee, sit outside and talk. And as much as that sounds really nice, it's also, I find, extremely important for the creative process because some of my favorite parts of the songwriting process are the beginning where you're just meeting the person and you're just schmoozing and getting to know them. And I don't find it separate. I find that that whole conversation and getting to know someone, that's so essential to the song that you're about to write. And sometimes the very topic that you were just talking about casually finds its way into the song. And also breaks, you know, you work for like 2 hours and if you hit a wall, so you go outside and you sit and you talk about anything else. And then that just, you step back into the studio and you have a lot better chance, I think, instead of trying to force it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting how all these, like, there's so many different elements within the music creation and the songwriting process and this and that. Mm-hmm. Like, I know you write obviously for like the bands that you're in, as well as you've also written for like music and TV more specifically. Is there a different process that you have going in to writing a song as a Distant Cousins song versus even as a Distant Cousins song for a movie or for a TV show?
Yeah, really good question. It is. It's totally different. I mean, I think the number one difference is you put on a different hat and it's you're there for a service. So when you're hired as a composer on a TV show or a film, or like you said, even if you're just writing with something in mind, with a project in mind, you're really there fulfilling that service. The director needs a song like this, and then it's your mission to create that. And so sometimes I enjoy that more, to be honest, because when you have that end goal in sight, it's kind of easier to reverse engineer it and get there. Whereas sometimes it's a little daunting to just be like, okay, what are we going to write about today? And, you know, those times, it's different for each person. Actually, my bandmate, David, who's also in Moshav Band, he writes their songs, and he's incredible. He'll just show up with, hey, I had this cool idea, and it's like the whole song, you know? I mean, I don't always work like that. I usually will have, like, bits and pieces, like a little verse idea, a chorus idea, just a lyric that I'll write down, or hum a melody in my phone, you know, and then it comes together. But it is definitely a different process where you still want to always, even with the composing and all of that kind of work for hire, you still want to make it authentic and come from a real place from yourself. But at the same time, you're thinking more about that end goal of what they need. And so, yeah, it's a different.
What did it feel like the first time seeing your music, like, in a movie or a show or like on TV, like that's my song. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's such a cool feeling and it actually doesn't get old. And I think if it did, that would be kind of sad to me because it's something that I've always loved just, you know, growing up. Like I always paid attention to the music in shows and movies and thought that'd be so cool if one day that's my music. And I do remember the first one. There have been some really cool moments. It's interesting because we don't find out how it's going to be used exactly until it actually is seen.
Uh-huh.
So just a quick little, background of the process. So, I mean, at this point, we have a company that we work with as the middleman. They're called the licensing company.
Uh-huh.
And so, a network will reach out to them and say, we really love this song, Raise It Up by Distant Cousins. We actually, this, like last week, our song Raise It Up was used in this NHL promo commercial. And so this is an example, like they reached out, they said they wanted to possibly use it. So they send you something called a request, and they request to use it, and you negotiate the fee, all of that. And they tell you, you know, how they might use it. It might use up to 30 seconds, up to the whole song, you don't know. But they don't send you a clip of it or anything. You just, and then they don't even send you a confirmation. We actually found out about that one because on our YouTube channel, we got an alert. Some fan in Russia was like, I found this song from the NHL commercial. I love this song.
That's crazy. So
then we realized, okay, I guess it went through. And then we tracked down the commercial and everything. So it makes for some, I mean, sometimes, to be honest, sometimes you watch it, you're like, really? That's how? And, but there, most of the time, it's incredible. There was one really funny story about that where, did you see the movie This Is Where I Leave You? It came out, I think, like 6 years ago now with Jason Bateman.
I don't think I've seen it.
Tina Fey. It's a very Jewish-y movie. It's about a family that loses a parent and all the siblings come to sit Shiva together. Mm-hmm. It's based on a book and it's really, really well done. And they ended up using our song, Are You Ready, as the closing song. So again, we didn't know exactly what that meant. We just knew, you know, that one we knew that it made it in. Mm-hmm. And they invited the band to come to the premiere. So that was like our big LA moment. This was like 6 years ago or something. And me, David, and Ami, we got all dressed up and we're like, this is it, you know? We went to the premiere with all the actors and everything. And we're sitting there and at the end, it gets to like what we thought was the last scene. And it was a different song. It was a song by, I'm blanking on who it was. It's such a good singer too. I love him. I want to say Sufjan Stevens, I think. It was like a beautiful song, and we looked at each other. We're like, oh, no. I think they must have cut us. Like, this is the last scene, and this is not our song. We just made such a big deal telling our family, our friends, we're here at the premiere. And it turns out that was the last scene, and then there was, like, one little closing, and then into the credits, and then our song came on. So we were like, oh. It was at that point, it was like a little bit of relief. Yeah, like, okay, it's really in. But it was... It is. It's incredible, especially on the big screen. It's so fun. And like our friends at the movies, like cheering, everyone's looking at them like, why are they cheering? What the heck's going on? So yeah, it's still fun.
So maybe take a step back. How was Distant Cousins formed? How did that come together?
So that was, and much like the name, it was because of like a lot of overlapping, and it was very familial. Like David, my bandmate, is also in Moshav. Mm-hmm. And so I met him as Blue Fringe was playing all these concerts, we would come across Moshav and played a bunch of concerts with them. And I love those guys, Yehuda. I'm close with Yehuda and David, but David and I had a real musical chemistry where we clicked and we would write songs kind of on the side here and there. Whenever I would come visit LA, because I have family here, we would get together and we'd write a song. And he said, you know, if you're ever here, we should really write more. And then my wife and I moved. So we got together, we started writing more. And then the real, you know, what solidified it and the glue was Ami, my bandmate Ami Kozak. Mm-hmm. I had known him from New Jersey, where I had lived before. And we went to the same high school. He's a lot younger, but still the same high school, mm-hmm. just different times. And he got together, we got together just for coffee when he moved, just to talk about the LA music scene and everything. And I told him what I was up to with David. And he ended up mixing the song and then suggested, why don't the three of us get together to write something? And then it was like instant chemistry, just like any good relationship. Like we sensed it. We ended up writing the song On My Way, which then got used like in a Macy's commercial like a month later. So it was just, thank God, it just felt like it had a lot of momentum and that we were trying to actually like keep up with it. And so... that was it. I mean, that started it from that first songwriting session. We've been working together now 6 or 7 years, and I love it.
Yeah.
All the time.
How stylistically did you guys end up creating indie rock? Like, is that just what your personal musical influences are? Like, that's what you kind of gravitate towards? Or how did you guys take that route?
Yeah, it's a good question. A lot of the songs that David and I had initially written were a lot slower and sadder. Like a lot of the music I end up loving is, you know, Ray LaMontagne and Amos Lee and Damien Rice and just like a lot of kind of, I love, you know, all different styles, but we would tend to write some of that sadder songwriter-y stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was a conscious decision. We decided, you know what? We were pretty calculated about it, to be very honest. We said, you know, we all have, David has Moshav, we all have other projects. Let's write some music that can get licensed, that can be used in commercials and that could be used. And so we really were, in the beginning, we were thinking a lot more about the focus of where these songs are going to live. And that kind of dictated some of the sound, like, you know, and then obviously we still tried to make it our own. But then from there, we realized, okay, I think we're actually a band. Like, this isn't mm-hmm. just a fun little project to license songs. We have, I think, you know, we all have the showmanship. We've performed. And, like, as soon as we started performing live, it became clear, like, you know, we can definitely do this. And there's a need for it. So it's the sound kind of blended, I would say, naturally, because Divid is, you know, grew up on good old folk singer-songwriters, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, the classics like Dylan and Neil Young and Joan Baez and all of that. So that's always going to be in him. I tend to gravitate more towards like the Death Cab for Cuties, you know, uh-huh. And Wilco and all that kind of, I don't know, indie rock, I guess. Uh-huh. And Ami tends to lean a lot more towards the pop side of things, which is uh-huh. cool because, you know, he'll take a song that could just be on an acoustic guitar and give it this crazy cool backing beat and everything that we wouldn't have thought to do with synth sounds and making it sound really modern. And so it's kind of this really cool blend. When we play live, it's just like we say folky just because we got the harmonies and the acoustic instruments. So it feels folky, you know, but structurally, a lot of the times the songs are a lot more pop. Mm-hmm. But instrumentation and arrangement tends to lean towards the folk.
Interesting, especially like the way we were talking about earlier of how each person in the group has like their own role. Yeah. It's kind of like very, the way you described it right there is very distinct. And it's like very, I feel like especially the person who's doing the production, it's even more convenient that they have that, like that pop kind of style to it. Cause that's where you can really, like you can punch something up to being more commercial. And I think that's kind of important.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, and then we always kind of push each other. There's a push and pull. Like sometimes we'll go a little too far in one direction and say, all right, let's get rid of some of those synths. Let's get some more real mm-hmm. acoustic raw feeling in there, or vice versa. Or sometimes it's too raw and we need a little more synth or production. So yeah, there's a cool.
No, that makes sense. I'm going to transition a little bit over here. I saw that you, I don't know if you still do, but you taught a class at Shall Have It about.
Yeah.
Like understanding tefillah through songwriting. And maybe if you want to just tell me more about that, because I just thought that concept until I had heard that like described, I didn't even think about it. And like you think about it, like King David, David HaMelech is
like, they're basically
is the ultimate lyricist.
Yeah, like Tehillim is a bunch of lyrics, right. So yeah, I mean, I grew up modern Orthodox and going to Jewish day schools. And I always, davening, you know, tefillah, prayer was always a very big part of my life. But to be honest, I don't think I really ever... I'm still trying to fully understand what I say and the concepts behind it and everything in it. And I just had this idea that songwriting to me is a way of processing my own emotions. And also just if someone gives me a topic and then I write a song about it, I feel like I come to understand it in a much deeper way. So I felt like it would be so cool to take a look at some of these prayers and really analyze them. As a song, like you mentioned, a lot of times you could just look at mm-hmm. the prayer as lyrics, and there's a lot of cool techniques used, whether it's the, you know, an acronym or acrostic is the word I'm looking for, you know, mm-hmm. the alphabetical. And then the other side of it is and this is what the class was, is that once you internalize all of that, then can you make it your own song? So, for example, like at Shall Have It, which is a high school here in Los Angeles, uh-huh. One of the songs that we worked on with the students was we looked at the prayer Baruch She'amar, which in the morning is like, I think, one of the first prayers we say. And it's all about, like, the first words are Baruch She'amar V'haya Olam. So blessed is he who spoke and the world was created. So right there, that's a super powerful idea. And there's tons of Hasidic stuff written about the power of words creating. And so without getting too into it, I mean, the students ended up writing a song. We wrote a song called Words Worth Worlds, which was a tongue twister. But it was all about the power of words and that what we say creates a world around us and it affects those around us. And that, that's the beauty of starting your day with that prayer is you're also kind of reminding yourself the words that I'm saying now and throughout the day have weight. They're important, you know. I think there's a line in there, it's been a while, but there was something in there where like the gematria or something adds up to gold. And the idea is that like your words have weight and also value like they're gold and you should treat them as such. So
that's powerful. Yeah. I wonder, did that kind of transition into what you guys are doing now, this Cousins in the Classroom project?
Yeah, it did, just because I had that, you know, idea of songwriting workshop. But what we're doing now, it's not really about tefillah, but sometimes we have, but it kind of started, we were in New Orleans for a Limud conference, and while we were there performing, they said, can you also just lead a workshop with some kids? So we did a songwriting workshop with them, and like you said, it was kind of based on something I had done already, and I just told Divid and Ami, let's try going with this. But like with most things Distant Cousins, when the three of us work on it together, it's just so much better than any one of us alone. And we really walked out of that first class, like with those kids in New Orleans. It was just a group of maybe 10 or 15 kids, and we wrote this cool song about Pesach. It was leading up to Passover, and it was called, I think it was called Passing Over. Genius. But they loved it and we loved it, and we walked out of there, we're like, wow, there's really something here that we have to tap into. And so we started developing this songwriting workshop a little more in person, and then when the pandemic hit in March or April, we were commissioned by the Diller Foundation, who they work with teenage Jewish leaders all over the world. Actually, I think they have 32 different cities and like over 600 kids. And we immediately signed on to work with all of them. And we wrote, they have 16 partnerships, two cities. And we wrote 16 original songs with all these kids. And it was quite mind blowing, actually. We were a part of it, but it was incredible. And so, yeah, now that's become our main focus in a way right now, is this songwriting workshop.
Yeah, I feel like especially with the pandemic, it's like that perfect, like it kind of came, like you see how things come at like the perfect time of like being able to build into things.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were one or two that we had scheduled before that were going to be in person that then we obviously had to switch to Zoom. And in a way, it's so much better for the process, and also it's really needed and meaningful. I mean, I'm speaking highly of it, and I hope that's, I'm a fan of it also just like witnessing it, you know, like obviously I'm part of leading it, but seeing how these people, like we just did one with a bunch of a staff, there were like over 100 staff, and these people aren't seeing each other on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, adults don't really get the opportunity to process those emotions, you know, like it's maybe kids sometimes do that, but adults don't have that setting. And so the songwriting becomes this like cathartic experience where they're able to talk about what they're going through and have fun with it and turn it into a song. Like it's just, I love it.
No, that's also really powerful, because like it's kind of what music does for all of us. It kind of is able to help us deal with emotions and work through things. And I think it's even more so like when you're actually writing those songs and creating those songs that you like, you have an ownership of it. It's not just, oh, that's a song that I like, but this is like a song I created that helps me get through something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where do you see, as a broader thing, the role of like music in Judaism as a whole? I know that's a very broad question, but
right. Well, so, I mean, there's a whole conversation about, like, what Jewish music is. Mm-hmm. And we ran up against that with Blue Fringe all the time. I often found it funny how, like, there was some pushback with us because it was like, is that really considered Jewish music? They're singing in English. It sounds like they're singing about a girl. Like, we had this song, City of Gold, that uh-huh. was, it's called City of Gold, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav.
Uh-huh.
And we got all these emails like, this is so inappropriate. It sounds like it's a love song to a girl. What are you doing? So I think Jewish music as a whole is, you know, a matter of learning from what's been done already and then mm-hmm. trying to move it forward. So, you know, I always loved, obviously, Carl Bach, Shlomo Carl Bach, and I listened to a lot of Soul Farm, and then I got to be in a band with C, Landsbaum,
yeah.
and Moshav and all that. So it's like, you know, learn in general, and I find like the connection is that that's such a Jewish idea of learning from your past, where you came from, and really internalizing that, speaking out like your own voice, and thinking about where that's going to go, you know. So in Judaism and in music, I feel like those are so connected. But I mean, there's also, to be honest, there's a whole nother side of it, which is just the nigunim and the Hasidic kind of spirituality of singing, and that role in Judaism is something I feel like I've come to appreciate a lot more as I get older.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had a bit of an aversion to it, to be honest. When I was like in Blue Fringe days, it was like, no way, we're a contemporary band. We listen to Coldplay, we listen to, you know. And I did not want to have anything to do with like, any of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now, partly because I married a Chabad girl, and so my whole in-law family is Chabad, I've learned to love a lot of nigunim and everything and the Hasidic kind of spiritual meaning behind a lot of them. But I think that's a beautiful side of the music within Judaism and that we have it in the davening, and it's something I'm constantly trying to get better at myself, honestly.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I feel like all of us, even you being in the band even more so, but like kind of you have to like almost gravitate back towards that kind of music. Like it's maybe mm-hmm. something that played a role when you were younger, and then kind of you kind of almost went into like, if you want to call it like the punk rock phase in a sense.
Yeah.
Of like that kind of like aversion to what you started with, and then like kind of grew more into like the rock phase, and then kind of like eventually you kind of grow out of that, but then also
yeah.
keep the elements from that, which I think is also, like you're saying, which is kind of beautiful of how you can keep the elements and grow, and like that you take from a positive from certain experiences and leave necessarily the negatives and then grow forward with that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that it, well, first of all, it makes me think of that Carl Bach song, Return Again. Return Again. It's something that you come back to. And also, I think that that's a, you know, musically, in most musicians' journey, that's kind of a mature process, which is that at first you kind of have an aversion to the simplicity of things, you know, like, oh, that song's so easy, it's so boring, it's three chords.
Mm-hmm.
I want to learn, you know, I want to play the hard stuff, I want to learn the complicated stuff. We went through that with Blue Fringe. Our second album was like all over the place. There was like jazz influences, funk influences, you know, we were musicians in college learning all that stuff, and we wanted to experiment and stretch out and play it. And then you come back around and you realize the simplicity is actually the hardest sometimes to achieve and to appreciate. And, you know, I guess it's like a country saying, like, all you need is two chords and the truth,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, there are some songs that are just absolutely heartbreaking and beautiful that are two chords, and it's just an amazing lyric that, you know, speaks to your heart. So, or a nigun, like we're talking about, a wordless melody where you don't even need any lyric. You could just sing it and you feel it. And so there's real depth in the simplicity that I think at first, you know, at least I'll speak for myself, at first I didn't really fully appreciate, and I'm still trying to come around.
Yeah, no, I think like we've talked a lot about songwriting. I think that's kind of also is like, it has to come from one side or the other. Like if you have complicated lyrics, you don't necessarily need complicated musicality.
Right.
If you don't have complicated lyrics, I feel like it almost, it kind of,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say requires, but in a way requires more complex musicality, because you want something simple and you want something complex within the same song.
Yep, absolutely. That's what you're talking about is something that we always try to relay in our workshops too, which is that they're, without realizing it, I think people respond a lot to contrast. And so what you're saying is spot on. It's like there needs to be some sort of contrast, whether it's like a rhythmic thing where, you know, the verses are a lot more sparse, you know, and then all of a sudden the rhythm kicks in and there's a contrast there. Mm-hmm. Or just within the writing itself, like you said, where the lyrics are kind of basic, but the musicality of it all propels it. You know, so yeah, I think that's something that we actually are conscious about when we're writing. It's like there needs to be some contrast.
That makes sense. I think we've talked about a lot of what goes into like how you started creating the music with Distant Cousins, but do you have like, mm-hmm. for the band in particular now, do you have a goal for the music you're creating aside for getting it licensed?
Right. You know, the truth is the licensing has been happening in general less and less. Like, in a way, well, there's always a need for licensing music, but I guess it felt like maybe 5 years ago or something, there was this wave of like not everybody had caught on. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like very oversaturated to the point where it's almost random, like any random little song can get licensed. So yeah. So that's not necessarily our focus so much anymore. And honestly, what we always talk about among the three of us is we just want to keep making music, the three of us, and any way to do that at this point in our lives. Also, we all have families, and you know, just to be able to be making music and making a living from it, you know, we're wide open to the possibilities. We've been working with DreamWorks Animation on some cool projects where we write songs for some of their kids shows, which mm-hmm. I just never thought, you know, I'd be doing, but I'm perfectly happy. I love it. My kids love it. So we really just try to do whatever we can so that we can continue creating music together. But as a band, we have a whole new batch of songs, and we're always trying to push ourselves to keep writing and releasing new music. So mm-hmm. we are working on the next batch now. I don't know if it'll be an EP or a full album. We have this weird split really in our music where, I don't know if you've heard any of it on Spotify, but like mm-hmm. this last one we just put out, it was an acoustic, a live album that we just did, the three of us in a studio, some musicians here and there, but that stuff tends to just sound a lot more raw and real and true to the way we perform. Mm-hmm. And then there's the, like the records where we go full out and it's like AMI full on production, which I'm not putting down at all. Those are incredible records and they've done very well for us, thank God. But mm-hmm. there's a split, and so we're trying to really figure out how to balance it, you know?
Yeah. When you put out, let's say you're writing songs for DreamWorks or whatever else, do those songs get released also, or is that like its own thing? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, good question. I mean, technically, if it's like something like that, they own the song, so they do end up releasing some of them. There's this show called Kipo. It's on DreamWorks. It's a DreamWorks Animation. It's a really cool show, actually. Mm-hmm. Like young adult animation. And we wrote a few songs for the different episodes that they had their cast sing, and then they released it on Spotify. Uh-huh. So
interesting.
You can hear it. You would never know that that Distant Cousins wrote it, but you know, they have them out there. And then there's one of them actually that we were talking about maybe doing our own version and putting it out, because it's just a really pretty song. So mm-hmm.
keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, yeah. It's What I Have Is You or something like that.
Uh-huh. What's, I guess, a little bit of a transition, but like, what's your favorite part of like performing on stage, and like, how does that work for you?
Performing on stage has an interesting dynamic, because it's, on the one hand, we're having our own experience up there as a band. Mm-hmm. And there are times where you just zone everything else out and you just listen to each other and the music that you're making, and you have that experience as a band. But most of the time I'm very aware of the audience and how reciprocal in nature it is, because energy that they give us in turn pushes us to, you know, kick it up a notch or vice versa if, mm-hmm. if the audience is just dead. So I'm very aware of that. And honestly, that was one of the things that I think drew me to it in the beginning and keeps me all the time is the personal connection. It's unbelievable the power, and I can see it from both sides, myself being in the audience sometimes at a concert as well, the connection that you feel to the performer up there, and the performer feels it as well. And it's a very real, hard to describe, you know, intangible connection, but you feel it when you talk to people after the show and they tell you how they connected to the music, or there's just, I can't think of anything else like that in my life where you can quickly connect to someone in a very deep, meaningful way. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And I feel that way also like with musicians when you get together to write or jam, it's just, you know, it's that Stevie Wonder lyric. Music is a language in itself. Like you just connect immediately through it.
Yeah, no, it's that for me as a photographer, that moment right before like the band gets on stage and you're like waiting there, and just that mm-hmm. level of just energy and anticipation and everything combined. Yeah. And then just like, I feel like for me, like the biggest, what I call it, loss during the pandemic, obviously there's been terrible losses yeah. as well, but is the ability not to be able to connect with people through music, like standing mm-hmm. in a crowd of 1,000 people and you're just all, everyone's in sync. It like the whole, mm-hmm. the whole room is just in sync, the musicians, the fans, everybody. And like, that's like that, like you're touching on like the beauty of live performances is that ability to all just synchronize.
Yeah. I mean, this is the podcast to talk about it, you know, faith through music. To me, it's a very spiritual experience. I mean, again, there's just not much like that where this group of 1,000 people feels deeply connected to each other through a song. I mean, that's, yeah. it's crazy. And I feel lucky to be a part of it on, you know, from both sides. But yeah, I think that's the, if you want to like really read into harmony and what all that is those are musical terms, but that's also what we dream of when people get along and peace. And like, there's really something to be said for that unspoken harmony that happens, you know, at those concerts. So yeah, I agree. I wish it would return real soon.
Yeah, the best way I always describe it is that literally like you take 3 hours and you just forget what's going on in the rest of the world. Like, it's pretty crazy. Yeah. Like even just like during COVID, I shot a Smith and Myers show, which is Shinedown. They mm-hmm. have like an acoustic project. And like, it was the night of one of the presidential debates. And like, for a second, mm-hmm. I checked Twitter and just turned it off. But like, I completely forgot the debate was even like happening that night. Like, yep. it was just like, I'm here. Here's the music. That's all that matters right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I find that all a lot. That music is a much needed escape.
Yeah. Yeah. What's it been like? I know you've toured and stuff like that. How does that work mm-hmm. with like Shabbos, and how have you coordinated that into your experience?
Not well. It does not work well. I really only went on one big tour. I was in a band called The Wellspring, me and this girl Talia Osteen, mm-hmm. and the two of us opened for Ben Queller and Pete Yorn, and it was like 30 cities, and we were the opener, you know, before Ben went on and played his set, and then Pete uh-huh. Yorn. We got very lucky, I will say. We had a corporate sponsor who was a travel company, and so just full disclosure, because I feel like it's not fair to talk about it without this piece of it, uh-huh. is that they contributed some of the funding. So because of that, we were able to kind of negotiate our terms a little more, which was that we didn't play on Friday night. So mm-hmm. most of the time, and this happens all the time, sadly, with Distant Cousins, you get offered a tour and then you have to turn it down because there's Friday night and Saturday shows that you can't play, and they don't want to go through the headache of, okay, Distant Cousins will open Monday through Thursday, and then we'll have to find another band in Boston for that weekend and another band in Dallas. No booking agent wants to deal with that. They just want to find, there's a million other bands that will just say yes.
Yeah.
So that really kind of shut down the touring option for Distant Cousins. And we knew that. But for The Wellspring, we were able to do that, and it was incredible. Basically, I would travel to wherever the Saturday night show was. Mm-hmm. I would travel there and just have Shabbat by myself at the hotel and meet up with them and be ready for the Saturday night show and then continue on the tour. So that was a quite unique, incredible experience. I think I got really lucky with. But most of the time, Distant Cousins had a booking agency here in Los Angeles that they said after about a year of working together, they were like, we love you guys. We love your music. We've never had a band say no this often, and we don't know what to do with you. So we, you know, our touring was never, for Distant Cousins at least, was never really our big, you know, we love playing live, but it wasn't our main thing. Our main thing is the writing piece, writing and production.
Yeah. We kind of touched on a few, but do you have any like stories or anything like that from any like either like Jewish or secular artists that you've performed with over the years?
Ah, so many stories. I mean, there's so, we once opened up for Amos Lee, who I'm a big fan of, at Rockwood Music Hall. I think Amos, and then there's this other one I was going to tell you about, which I'm realizing, I think the ones I'm drawn to, the musicians that we've opened for that I'm drawn to are the ones that are kind of the most quiet off stage and even on stage and just like very humble. And there was we played when I was with C. Lansbaum, we were asked to be the backing band. They were doing a big Elton John and Bernie Taupin tribute concert at Carnegie Hall. And I mean, that was, you know, as a musician, any performer, you feel like a real privilege to be able to play on that stage at Carnegie Hall. And so we went through, we were the backing band for, I don't know, maybe six or seven different artists and singers. And so we obviously had some rehearsals leading up to it. And we had, there's this one singer, I don't know if you've ever heard of her, her name is Phoebe Snow. She passed away. She was a powerhouse singer. And when I met her, she was already a little older and her health was deteriorating a little. And I just, I formed this sweet bond with her, and she actually lived near me in New York at the time. And so I think I went over to her apartment to help. She wanted to go over it again. I don't, it's, it was mind boggling to me because she has the most powerful, incredible, beautiful voice. And I was struck by just how sweet and down to earth she was. She had her, you know, her time in the limelight. If you look her up, Phoebe Snow, she's incredible. And then at the performance, she, of all the performers, and she wasn't necessarily the most famous one there, you know, the biggest name. She brought down the house with her rendition. It was an Elton John song. I think it's called Secret Garden, Magic Garden. I mean, the whole place, the whole Carnegie Hall was standing ovation, going crazy for her. And what I loved about that moment was she just deserved it so much. And it was just because of her voice and her charm and her sweetness. And it wasn't like one of these diva showboats that's like trying to get you, you know. She earned it, like just with her musical prowess. I just, for some reason, that always stood out to me. I love that.
Yeah, no, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Last few things, which is, I guess, are there any either Jewish or secular artists that you like, you're keeping an eye out on, that you like, you're either that you're listening to or that's like, that's coming up, that you see are coming up these days?
I love finding new music. Most of the time I will just put on, you know, some sort of a band that I like, their radio station on Spotify, or because just like Pandora was, or maybe still is. Sorry, I don't use Pandora anymore. But
same, I kind of I've made the transition. Now it's like you can't go back.
Spotify just makes it so easy. Like, you have your own playlist, you can hear other. So I like just putting on something I know and then seeing what else happens. And then I'll usually take like a screenshot of a song that I like, so I can I have a folder of all the screenshots that I like, so I can come back to it.
Nice.
And I have a note you know, in your notes in your phone. I have a note folder. Every time I'm having a conversation with someone that tells me a new band, I try as best as possible to actually write it down.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it just, you know, disappears in conversation. I mean, as far as particular bands, I can't say that I follow the Jewish music scene so much anymore. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't really know. I mean, I've come across Zusha. I know they're not that new anymore either, but I like what those guys are doing. Otherwise, yeah, there's bands. There's Maggie Rogers. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just thinking.
Yeah,
of
no,
like,
Maggie Rogers has to be amazing. I feel like you've definitely seen the video with her. With, I think it was Pharrell.
Oh, with Pharrell. I just showed it to my wife.
Put together
this week.
Alaska. It was
incredible. It's incredible. And a lot of times, it actually the bond happens because of a story or something like that. Where you know. There's this band called Fruit Bats. Have mm-hmm. you heard of Fruit Bats?
I have not, no.
So cool. I find they're a good example because they just come up on some playlist that I have. Every time I hear them, I don't even know it's them. I'm just like, ooh, I love this. What is this? And I take a screenshot and it's Fruit Bats. So by default, I've become a fan.
Yeah. How often does this stuff that you're listening to end up kind of influencing the music you're creating yourself?
That's a good question. Often. I think that, first of all, you know, without me realizing it, almost everything you listen to and conversations you have, they find their way into your creation. Because mm-hmm. it's not like you're creating something out of nothing. It's stuff that's there in the atmosphere that you're just kind of tapping into. And then there are times where it's a lot more explicit and overt, and it's like, I love that song. I want to write a song that has a similar groove, you know, and you mm-hmm. kind of take the exact groove and then see where you go from it. I used to think that was like copying and not cool and not creative. And now I realize it's all about what you do with it to make it your own. I mean, you know how many songs have the same beat and the same chords? It's like, you're not going to recreate the wheel. It's like, how can you put your stamp on it and make it your own?
Yeah, no, I think that's the beauty of songwriting and creating these days.
Yeah, otherwise I would just give up. It's all been said.
Exactly. Know? There's been so much that's been created. It's a matter of how can you put your spin onto what's out there.
Yeah, exactly. You got to have faith that, you know, that if you work hard at it and you put yourself out there, that something will happen.
Yeah. Where can people find Distant Cousins and your work on social media, online, wherever else?
Well, Spotify is the number one place, I guess. If you look up Distant Cousins, we have a bunch of albums and Blue Fringe and The Wellspring and Apple Music and pretty much anywhere. The one place we're not on, Blue Fringe at least, is on YouTube, because mm-hmm. there was no YouTube back then. So. Which is crazy to think about, but pretty much most of the music lives on all those streaming platforms now. Yeah.
And I guess social media wise.
Oh, social media. We are at Distant Cousins Official. Mm-hmm. So it's official.
Did somebody snag that name before you or what?
Honestly, we had been working with a record label that hired some social media company, and they were like, oh, well, we're going to make you official and call you Distant Cousins Official. We're like, okay, that feels a little funny, and then we just never switched it back, so.
Yeah, no, that works. I feel like you guys always, there's a lot of fun stuff you guys have on your Instagram and stuff like that.
Thanks.
You put out a lot of like cute clips and stuff like that.
It's an interesting challenge, I'd say, because I find personally I'm not inclined to share all that much and be out there, but mm-hmm. I do see the value. I see how important it is, and you know, for us keeping in touch with people and for people to see what's going on. So we recently for the last few months, we've been splitting it up where each of us is responsible to post something. We each get 2 days a week. So, you know, I'm on Tuesdays and Fridays. Those are my days. Mm-hmm. And that way I know I have to do something. It could be anything. It could be personal, whatever it is. But I think that that's been working out really well, because it feels a lot more natural, as opposed to, we used to feel like only if all three of us are together, we can post something as the band, you know. But especially with COVID, we're not all together. So
yeah, No, that's a pretty cool way to break it up, and I feel like it makes it less overwhelming also.
Exactly, yeah. And we keep each other accountable, too. It's like, whose day is it?
Yeah.
It's empty.
Thank you again so much for joining. I really appreciate
you taking the time. Thanks for reaching out.
Hey, guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. For more conversations like the one you just heard, please follow us on Instagram at OurFaithThrough, THRU, music, and subscribe in your favorite podcasting app. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great rest of your day.